I'm going to begin this talk in a way that is customary for us in Australia when we give public presentations, and it's called an acknowledgement to country. Many of you might know that Australia is a settler colonial society. When the white settlers arrived, they did so by displacing the indigenous communities that were already there. And so while I'm not standing at this moment on Australian soil, this paper was completely formulated on Gadigal country, where my home is, and on Darug country, where my university is situated. And so I'd like to pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Sovereignty was never ceded, wasn't, always will be Aboriginal land. So as Vanessa mentioned, this paper is part of a broader project on writing and literary archive. And what me and my collaborators, Professor Helen Groff and Professor Julian Murfitt, are interested in looking at is the intersection, or the way that writers and literature have represented things like riots, protests, uprisings, crowd violence. And we're interested in thinking about what literature, fiction in particular, has to say about those instances of crowd violence in history. So you'll see in this paper that there's a little bit of talk about archives, and there's a little bit of talk about sound, which is another thread in our project. And this paper focuses on the Egyptian uprising. I'm going to give you a tiny bit of context about that uprising before I begin the paper. And it's going to be very brief and very crude. So in 2011, for 18 days across January and February, the Egyptian people, as you can see on the screen here, massed onto the streets and in public squares, in particular Tahrir Square, demanding that President Hosni Mubarak demand that he leave office. After 18 days of violence, they succeeded, and a man that had been president sometime in the 1980s stepped down. A year later, roughly in 2011, there were elections. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and President Morsi won those elections. And pretty much a year after that, in July 2023, there was a counter-revolution, and Morsi was forced to leave office. It was a very brutal kind of moment in Egypt, another brutal moment in recent Egyptian history. And we now have, since then, the rise of military, and President Sisi, being a former general of the Egyptian army, is currently the president of Egypt. So this paper kind of deals with some of those issues. Egypt's Arab Spring was a mediated series of events widely referred to as, at the time, the Facebook Revolution. While the use of this phrase has since declined, researchers continue to mine the collection of media platforms that recorded the 18 days that transformed Tahrir Square into a riotous battleground. A highly significant digital media site known as 858.ma, the Archive of Resistance, was filled with raw footage from major battles to street clashes, and it was all recorded by what we call street media activists. The hours of material, 858 apparently, while wonderful, have also been lamented by researchers for their sensory overload. The team behind this website, known as the Musrin Collective, were aware of the daunting nature of this abundance of data. And in a statement on their website, the Musrin team suggested that the way to give form to their digital collection is through narrative. And this is what they had to say. 858 is just one archive of the revolution. It is one collection of memories we can all use to fight the narratives of the counter-revolution, to pry loose the state's grip on history, to keep building new histories for the future. So taking inspiration on the significance of narrative for making sense of media footage, this paper expands the Tahrir archives to include fiction, in particular the novel, to examine the role of authors in mediating the uprising in Cairo. And the paper will focus on two novels. The City Always Wins, published in 2017 by Omar Robert Hamilton, and Chronicle of the Last Summer, published in 2016 by Yasmin Al-Rashidi. What is interesting about these authors is that prior to these debut novels, they worked in more realist sectors. Hamilton as a documentary filmmaker or film producer, and he was also one of the founding members of that Musrin Collective. and El Rashidi was a journalist. Despite working in industries where they reported on the uprising and were participants in the uprising, both authors expressed a need to turn to fiction to accommodate what they wanted to convey about this uprising. Their novels demonstrate that while digital media and journalism are widely perceived as closer to real life than works of fiction, literary texts have also played an underappreciated role in documenting Egypt's uprising. There are similarities between Hamilton and El Rashidi's justifications for their turn to fiction, especially a shared fascination with sound and silence and the desire to narrate the intense sonic textures of those riots that took place. Certainly, viewing any one of the many videos on that 858 website or its archive shows the degree to which this uprising was a highly rowdy affair. Gunshots were fired by plainclothes police, called in Egypt the Bultagaya, and protests had pelted thousands of rocks that clattered onto the square like rain. Sounds were also used strategically by both sides. Sonic booms came from the military and they were deployed specifically to scare the crowds and make them disperse, while protesters issued loud battle cries as a signal to attack. And as one rioter stated, "At 9 a.m, Thursday's first battle cry came. It began with a rhythmic banging sound as one man beat a pipe against the metal pole at the entrance to Cairo's underground train station. Then another joined in, banging a rock against a lamppost. And then dozens of men began whistling through their teeth, calling men to battle as they waved their hands, gesturing for hundreds to come forward." Lost in all that deafening sound, much like the abundance of data in the archives, are the stories or fragments of stories, like the one we just heard, that give shape to the chaotic nature of the uprising. Within Hamilton and El Rashidi's novels, are not only those lost sounds and voices of Egypt's uprising, but also the stories that give these sounds their meaning, stories which are capable of building new histories of the past and new narratives for the future. So why am I interested in fiction and why sound? These lost sounds are better explained with the aid of R. Murray Schafer's theorizations of low and hi-fi soundscapes. Schafer, I think he passed away only recently, and a very important figure in sound studies. He distinguishes between low and hi-fi frequencies, focusing on what each does or does not capture. A hi-fi system, he tells us, is one possessing a favorable noise, a signal-to-noise ratio. The hi-fi soundscape is one in which discrete sounds can be heard clearly because of low ambient noise level. The country is generating more hi-fi than the city. Conversely, in a lo-fi soundscape, individual acoustic signals are obscured in an over-dense population of sounds, a footstep in the snow or a church bell across the valley. These are masked by broadband noise. In the context of sound studies, I'd like to suggest that online data archives are more akin to noisy lo-fi cities where discrete sounds are obscured. Literature, however, aligns with Schafer's hi-fi countryside because it amplifies individual voices that might otherwise be lost to the acoustic environment. Hamilton and El Rashidi have explained turning to the novel when their original forms of mediating the events in Cairo failed them. For Hamilton, the 23 counter-revolution, in which the military, supported by some protesters, ousted the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood, was so violent that it shut down all dialogue, silencing the voices that participated in the 2011 uprising. Unable to continue his activism in Cairo, Hamilton relocated to New York with hard drives of the video footage from the 858 website. His intention was to make a documentary using that footage, but when he sat down to write the script of that documentary, what spilled out onto the page was prose. As he stated, "It only became clear a little while later that a novel was the only form that could handle all the different things that I wanted to say." Likewise, El Rashidi found her way to fiction through a process of writing into failure. While writing what she thought would be a work closer to journalism, El-Rashidi became interested in explaining the silence of the Egyptian people prior and following the Egyptian revolution. The silence she wanted to examine was not the kind that is imposed by the state, but also the kind that permeates Egyptian society, shaping private lives and intimate relationships within households. El-Rashidi sought to explain why the revolutionary, and I'm quoting here, eruption of this chorus of voices expressing discontent about things we Egyptians had been living for decades, quickly receded back into silence, end quote. Writing into failure, her non-fiction work was the result of her realisation that, and I quote again, the so-called facts did not provide the answers, or I did not know how to put those facts together to explain the riot of voices that quickly reverted into silence. In order to give voice to this silence, El-Rashidi needed to work in what she called a grey area, where definite fact ends and possible truth or possible fiction or multiple truths begin. For her, these grey areas could only be accessed in the form of the novel. The multiple truths that El-Rashidi associates with fiction are echoed in the statement from Musrin and probably also from Hamilton, because as I said, he was a member of that Musrin collective. And to return to this, 858 distinguishes between the state's grip on history, singular, a singular narrative of history, and how the archive aids in the creation of new histories, multiple histories, plural histories. Recognizing the need to find ways to record multiple truths, multiple histories and voices has relevance for making sense of the overwhelming chaotic structures that define riots. Now, in a book called Rioters Citizens by Paul Baghouli and Yasmin Hussein, they caution against the way political studies of riots tend to assume a determined or fixed narrative pattern to what is instead an indeterminate and messy series of events. They argue that a pitfall of research on riots is that it tends to treat a diverse crowd as a stable object. And I'm quoting here, a consequence of this is that all members in a crowd are assumed to embody the same characteristics, share the same political grievances that propel their violent behaviour. End quote. But these assumptions fail to capture the changing nature of the crowd, they argue. Despite degrees of coherence, a crowd is made up of a mix of people. It is not singular and does not possess a unified identity, nor are the events that take place reducible to a single narrative. Even though these may seem pretty obvious points for me to make, they bear repeating because they help to explain why some Egyptians who gathered in 2011 in Tahrir Square demanding the end of the Mubarak leadership were also among those who returned in 2013 to undermine the elected Muslim Brotherhood. Unlike the social science research that book Rioters Citizens critiques, works of fiction are not compelled to make sense of events. They're not compelled to give riots a coherent shape or to provide conclusions about a crowd's motivations by assuming that this crowd possesses a collective identity. Authors like Hamilton and El-Rashidi distort the reductive nature of riot analysis by highlighting the multiple voices within the crowd and employing an episodic structure to their novels. And now I'm going to move on to the novels. The first one, Chronicle of a Last Summer. This novel is a result of El-Rashidi's recourse, as she said, to the grey area of fiction, where she probes the culture of silence that she perceives defines Egyptian society. For a novel that was written to explain how Egyptian silence was transformed into a riot of voices in Tahrir, it is remarkable that it is not set in this period at all. The novel's episodic structure sidesteps 2011 completely and instead focuses on three distinct periods in Cairo's history, the summers of 1984, 1998, and 2014. Despite this urban setting, much of the story unfolds within the nameless female narrator's once grand but now very decaying family home in Cairo. El-Rashidi's novel then explores the significance of 2011, of the 2011 uprising through a wider temporal scope and in a narrower domestic context. In doing so, it displaces the centrality of Cairo and the year 2011. This displacement is important because during the 18 days of protests, the uprising was considered by various journalists as a watershed event, a moment of democratic transformation for Egypt. However, the swift success of the counter-revolution a mere 2 years later and the rise of another military dictatorship by 2013 showed that this transformative promise was not entirely certain. By describing the uprising, or by decentering the uprising, I should say, El-Rashidi's novel not only signals that 2011 needs to be contextualised to make sense of why Egyptians, impassioned to raise their voices in 2011, receded so quickly into silence. And there are two ways that the novel contextualises the 2011 uprising. The first is that it makes ample reference to other riots and revolutions in 20th century Egypt. References to political violence in Egypt's history appear in the novel's 1984 instalment, when the narrator is still a child in primary school. In a conversation that she overhears, in a conversation that she actually has with her communist cousin Dido, the narrator, having just been punished for daring to speak Arabic at her English school, is informed by Dido that her English school will repress her Egyptian nationalism, and that the 1919 Wafd revolt was staged to liberate Egypt from British imperialism. A subsequent conversation between Baba, her father, the narrator's father, and Dido highlights that Egypt had two revolutions, the 1919 revolt and the 1952 revolution, when Nasser's free officers declared Egypt a republic. While Baba tells the narrator that these earlier revolutions came and went and all their hopes were shattered, his words from the vantage point of 1984 uncannily align or portend the outcome of 2011. The novel, however, does not rest on the idea that history merely repeats itself, exploring instead how understandings of uprisings are revised in social space. And this is revealed during an extended discussion between the narrator and a shop owner, where they explore various meanings of the term revolution. It's a rather long quote, but it's worth going through. I hope you can see it. 1919, the Wafd revolting against the British. It wasn't really a revolution, he says. It was a popular uprising. I raise my eyebrows. But it was a revolt, I say. But there wasn't a change of system. The country didn't completely change. The British didn't leave until years later. So what is a revolution? 1952. But it was also a coup, he shakes his head. It can only be a revolution. Could it have been both? People didn't take to the streets. It was one system of power ousting and usurping another. That's a coup. Yes, he says, but it was against something that didn't represent the people. So it was a revolution for the people. Then 2011 was the same, I ask. That was a different kind of revolution, he says. But in the end, all that happened is the army forced Mubarak to step down, as in 52. The people forced him out, he says. But the army wanted that. He pauses. I offer. And 2013 was no different. He tilts his head and thinks for a long time. He isn't sure. It's something he feels conflicted about. What is interesting, I think, about this scene is the extended debate about terms and the events they describe. By including this, Chronicle suggests that past and present overlap and reverberate within social settings in daily occurrences like discussions between a store owner and a customer. The significance of social space is further explored by El-Rashidi when she reminds us that Egypt's past did not take place exclusively in its city streets or public squares, but also unfolded inside ordinary Egyptian homes. The focus on the domestic space constitutes the second means by which El-Rashidi challenges the central importance of 2011 and the physical site of Cairo. The novel opens and remains much of the time within the confines of a once grand family home. In the opening scene, readers learn that the upper floor of the house is inhabited by the narrator and her mother, while the lower floor, the domain of the narrator's grandmother, until her death in 1983, is sealed. According to the narrator, Mama's reluctance to open up the space stems from a general Egyptian desire for stability. Ours was in a culture used to change. Permanency was valued. We lived in the same space as we were born in. We married and moved around the corner. The less change, the less movement, the better. El-Rashidi's interest in the impact of Egypt's history of civil unrest on the intimate lives of her characters is tied closely to her preoccupation with speech and silence. One of the ways this is explored in the novel is through the narrator's film project. The film aims to investigate change or a lack of change in Egypt and what that means for Egyptians. The narrator begins the project by asking Egyptians, like normal Egyptians on the streets, if they are angry. She knows from experience that this will be a very challenging thing to do. While filming for a different assignment earlier in the text, which involved asking, and I quote here, passers-by, what they would like to see improved in their city, she was met with subjects who only walked away, who not only walked away, but also looked at her skeptically, asked, who was really asking, and concluded that they couldn't answer such questions, couldn't speak about the city, couldn't speak about the country. Sorry, you know how it is. I don't want to get in trouble. When the narrator begins her film script in the 2014 installment, she emphasises the danger of not speaking in the opening lines, which read, "The only way our lives will change is if we demand it. Leaving Egypt is the greatest evil, then silence." While the narrator is preoccupied with silence that surrounds her, there are explicit registrations of sound and voice in the novel that, read retrospectively, are illustrative of the persistent unrest that foreshadows the 2011 Egyptian revolution. One of those registrations is a sound-based defiance issued from religious quarters. The adhan, the Muslim call to prayer, interrupts the narrator and her mother's evening as it sounds from across the river and echoes into the house. This sonic intrusion is infused with a sense of trouble. The president had issued a decree banning mosque speakers above a certain decibel, but they had become louder again. It was the most pertinent daily reminder of the increasing antagonism between the brotherhood and the state. The trace of that antagonism between the state and religion, which became the major battle line in post-Mubarak Egypt, is here reflected by the Muslim Brotherhood's weaponization of the call to prayer, a sound that is difficult to police given its sacred status. The politicization of the adhan is not unlike Mama's own politicization, and the way that a shift in Mama from silence to sound or to speech is wrapped up in voice. The first two installments of the novel include many instances of Mama gesturing with her eyes, using mannerisms and her hands as a mode of communication rather than speaking. The narrator depicts her mother as a woman of few words, one who may have political views but does not participate in political activity. When we meet Mama again in 2014, the 2011 uprising has intervened, making her much more vocal. As the narrator notes, "Although I see Mama's weariness, I know something has shifted. She has become involved with a community association, writes letters and petitions, joins marches, spends what little free time she has walking around the city, talking, taking pictures of things that need to change." During the marches against the newly elected President Morsi and his controversial and probably strategically bad sort of ideas about the Constitution or what he wanted to do with the Constitution, Mama joins the crowd on the streets while Baba, who was the one that used to be politically active, stays at home. By the end of the novel, Mama has found her voice and speaks out about social and ecological justice, a stark contrast to her silence prior to the revolution. Mama's turn toward politics is evident not only in her activism, but also in her relation to her family home. In 2014, right at the end of the novel, Mama states that she views her house as the weight of a physical burden. She decides to sell the only home in which she has ever lived to free herself from the past. By ending here inside Mama's home and inside of her personal thoughts, Chronicle of a Last Summer keeps the reader's attention on the intimate and the private, giving us insights into how uprisings alter people's lives in ways that are better suited to being narrated in fiction, that supposed grey area where definite fact ends and multiple truths begin. Moving on to The City Always Wins. Much like El Rashidi's novel, Hamilton's The City Always Wins utilises sound to explore the aftermath of Egypt's Tahrir uprising. While not focused on the home space as much, Hamilton examines the relationship between public riots and their impact on the private lives of individuals and families. Opening in late 2011, Hamilton's narrative also avoids those key 18 days in January and February. It also oscillates between public environments, city streets and public squares, and some private spaces, including the headquarters of a revolutionary movement known as Chaos Cairo, the home of Khalil and Mariam, the novel's two main characters, and Khalil's recording studio. The role of noise in the novel's more private settings is crucial to understanding the broader impact of the riot's very messy form, and especially the way that it seeps into and shapes the lives of its two main characters. One important way that sound is featured in the city is in its engagement with multiple media forms. The narrative is centered around the activities of Chaos Cairo, a team of revolutionaries who come together following the 2011 uprising to organize resistance and disseminate information. Information is packaged in podcasts, video montage, text messages and photographs, and disseminated via a range of social media platforms. The preoccupation with media in the novel mirrors the early reception of Egypt's revolution, when it was referred to as the Facebook revolution, as I mentioned earlier. At the time in 2011, the use of new media technologies by Egyptian youth was interpreted by various Western academics as a pathway to modernity and a means by which Egyptians could become more politically engaged. Such optimism is reflected in the novel when Khalil, Chaos Cairo's sound engineer, insists that the revolution is unstoppable, and this is what he says. Chaos will carry the news. They can't keep up with us. An army of Samsungs, Twitterers, HTCs, emails, Facebook events, private groups, iPhones, phone calls, text messages. An army of infinite mobility, impossible to outmaneuver. Amidst its attention to the role of media devices in facilitating the uprising, the novel also explores the dilemma of narrating the wider story of the events in 2011. Hafiz, a filmmaker within the Chaos group, announces to the team that the story of the 18 days in Tahrir can only be told through cinema, and this is what he says. "I got it," he says. "It's a movie. It's the only way to do it. You can't write a thesis about it, or a poem, or a song, or a book. It's just too big. It's too cinematic. It's got to be a movie. The whole country pours out, takes the streets, beats the pigs, burns down their police stations. It's not about one hero. It's just too big. Think of all the stories, the guys running into burning party headquarters, people breaking out of prison, burning down police stations. Shit, there's just so many scenes." Although Hafiz tragically dies before he can even complete this cinematic work, his realization that no single voice can tell the story of the uprising and the many scenes that are needed to capture the enormity of this narrative are evident in the actual structure of the city, the novel, that is, The City Always Wins. This is best reflected in the way that the novel includes various interludes that take readers to marginal characters and their own experiences of the uprising. These characters operate outside of the Chaos Cairo collective, and while not necessarily part of any organized revolutionary movement, they are all active in the resistance. The most significant of these alternative voices comes from Abu Basim, the father of the martyr Basim, who was among those killed in Tahrir Square. During the first of the three Abu Basim interludes, readers learn that he is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood and is seeking justice for the death of his son. By the second encounter with Abu Basim, his quest for justice has progressed. He has discovered the name of the officer who killed his son and the station where that officer works. Abu Basim decides not to seek revenge after he is advised by the Brotherhood leadership to be patient, and this is what they say to him. "We will avenge your son, but we must play the game. We must take power through an orderly path to elections. We must be patient." And so Abu Basim waits. In the end, however, his patience is futile. The Brotherhood do win the elections, only to be removed from office during a counter-revolution a year later. Having lost both his son and the Brotherhood, the final installment of the Abu Basim story sees him sitting in a cyber cafe, headphones over his ears, watching YouTube footage of his son, wondering what will happen if the footage he repeatedly watches, and I'm quoting here, breaks or is lost or deleted. What if today is the day I find I have nothing left? There are several other stories that I could narrate to you beyond this particular one, but the cumulative effect of including these diverse perspectives ensures that The City Always Wins is not just the story of one segment of Egypt's resistance. The multiplicity of voices and perspectives is further emphasised through Khalil's activist work as a Chaos Cairo sound engineer. Khalil uses his skills to ensure that the news of Bassem's brutal murder is widely known. Sitting in his studio, he cuts a week's worth of footage into a montage that forms a sound narrative of Bassem's death. And here's another lengthy quote. Khalil hit pause, holding the moment, the intimacy of his sound studio with its low roll of acoustic cotton hanging down from the ceiling. He takes a breath before placing the headphones over his ears, the conductor before his orchestra. A moment, and he will begin flicking through the sound files one by one, scanning for highlights and grabbing them with loose British cuts to drop them into five categories: essential, secondary, ambient, cutaway, effect. Five colours for five pillars with which to build the week's oral architecture. Five colours with which to make the listener see the pain of Abu Bassem to join his visual. He presses play on the video once more. We know his name now. We know his name is Bassem. These attempts by Khalil to shape sound's message through a curated method of oral architecture in the intimacy of his studio stand in stark contrast to the rowdy and violent riot public scenes that pepper the narrative. During these scenes, the narrator describes the crowds as an imprint, and I'm quoting on and off here, impenetrable herd of wolves that disperse when they hear the crackle of taser snaps through the air. The crowd is loosely organised, where, and I'm quoting, 100 people make up a front line of stone throwers and shit talkers hurling everything they have at the cops. Behind them, the fire starters and gas catchers hurling smoking canisters back where they came from, and behind them again are the spectators, the chanters, the drummers, the doctors, the quarriers, and the hawkers. End quote. This vivid description of rioters highlights the degree to which the crowd is never simply a homogenous, angry, undifferentiated mass. Rather, it is constituted by a range of actors, each armed to take on a different form of resistance. It is to these sites of chaos that Khalil records hours of ambient data to later give shape and rhythm to the battle, as he says, and to ensure that the deaths of many martyrs are neither unknown nor forgotten. Khalil's reliance on sound to narrate the street battles is counterbalanced by Mariam's investment in listening. Mariam starts off in the novel as his partner and they kind of part ways by the end. Sorry if I gave anything away, but you can kind of tell by the beginning. One of the earliest scenes that details their internal thoughts takes place after several days of violent confrontation between rioters and state forces in November 2011. Standing in a morgue surrounded by an overwhelming number of dead bodies, Mariam reflects on the lost opportunity presented by the initial success of the uprising. And this is what she has to say. We could have done more. We should have made the people listen sooner. We were too slow, and now they've made the deal with the Brotherhood, and all we have are rocks. The elections are upon us. They think elections can end a revolution. Khalil is thinking of voting. How can he even think about it? What is he thinking? What are we supposed to do? Pack up the morgue and quietly file into the polling station? That's what all this death was for, to be forgotten with a ballot. For Mariam, curating sound files is ineffective unless people listen, and the Chaos Cairo team has failed in her estimation because they were unable to make the masses listen to their messages. What is significant about this attention to listening is that it is raised in the shadow of the impending elections to come in Egypt. In Arabic, the word for vote is salt. Literally, salt means voice. So to vote in Arabic is to give yourself a voice in political decisions. At first glance, it seems that Mariam's statement positions listening as the opposite of voice, and that the power of salt is lower or less important to the power of listening to the power of sama. Sama is listening in Arabic. But in Arabic, of course, nothing is ever so simple. There is an instance in the Arab world, in the Sufi tradition, where a person reciting a praise poem is not referred to a mughanni, a singer, but is referred to as a musama, a listener. In light of this, perhaps the novel, as opposed to Mariam the character, is suggesting that it is not only the people who need to listen intently, but also those who have the opportunity to have their voices heard, those who emerge as the leaders of the resistance. Rather than focusing on broadcasting information, maybe what is needed for members of movements like Chaos Cairo to become listeners themselves, receivers of information, to become more attuned with what was unfolding around them and the complexity that was unfolding around them. So in conclusion, both Hamilton and El Rashidi's novels attempt to avoid the dangers of enclosed narratives of the Egyptian of Egypt's revolution. By turning to fiction, both authors are able to depict crowds as nuanced and varied. They can clear narrative space to delve into the lives of individual rioters, showing their differing political affiliations, the hardships they face, and the tragic impact of Egypt's history of uprisings on their families. While The City Always Wins achieves this through the incorporation of multiple characters, Chronicle of a Last Summer's focus on the domestic sphere of the narrator highlights the transformative effects of the city's violence on the intimate lives of its citizens. Both authors' shift to the novel in an age of digital media density was driven by their desire to narrate the multiplicity and complexity of Egypt's uprising. Literature makes possible the ability to shed light on that complexity because it approximates Schaffer's hi-fi frequency. As such, both novels amplify certain voices or a range of voices and stories, setting these against the noisy, lo-fi soundscapes generated by digital media, where individual voices and sounds are often drowned out. Thank you.